This is a recording from the Massachusetts Software Council Open Source Summit, which was also the Software Council's Open Source Special Interest Group's kickoff meeting. The meeting was held on June 24, 2005. The event was sponsored through the generosity of Essential Software, and the cost of audio taping was paid for by Novell. Software Garden took care of processing the tapes into audio computer files and uploading them to the internet. This is the luncheon keynote by Mark Fleury, founder, chairman, and CEO of the JBoss Group. There is a short break about 45 minutes in when the cassette was turned over.
Thank everybody for their attendance. We feel like this is a great first group and a great meeting. We've gotten a large group and pretty much filled the room. So we're very pleased with the turnout and want to thank everybody for their support. Our next speaker, Mark Fleury, we really appreciate him coming to Boston to visit with us. I think he just got off a plane from London, and he's heading back out to Atlanta where his headquarters is after this presentation. But Mark is the CEO of JBoss, which is a very successful open source project in the app server market. He's going to take us through all of that. He is one of the lead, again, founders and creators of a very successful open source project. So I think we've gotten a good mix today of various projects. But Mark grew up in France. He has a PhD in physics. He started his career at Sun. Then he spent time at SAP Labs. And then in 1999, he founded the JBoss project and created a commercial company around it, which today I would say is one of the most successful open source independent software companies. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mark. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Hello, everyone. Today I would like to focus not so much on projects and open source nonprofit nature, but really how do we make money at open source? And I think it's a timely question given what is going on in the market right now and the impact of open source. So I'll try and shed a very much a financial light on open source and focus on what we saw as the challenges of building a business in open source. Where is the money? So this is what a VC, somebody fairly known at least, actually Sequoia Capital, said. This was actually Doug Leone. He was right off his cloud because he'd just done the VA Linux IPO, which is, if you remember, was the poster child for first day increase. And this was a couple weeks after that IPO. I meet with Doug Leone. We're all excited. It's my first, real VC. Sit down with a business plan, and we tell him we're going to sell free software. And he asks who the competition is, and the competition's IBM and all that. And he said this. This is not a bad business plan. It's a horrible business plan. And what I'm going to talk about is, well, obviously, this is one extreme view. But in between, I don't want to call it naive, but maybe the romantic exaggerations of open source, which are fine if you're a teenager living at home or a student who's rent and college is paid for. Between those romantic exaggerations of people work for free, which to me is the basic lie of open source. People don't work for free. People like free when they receive, not what they give. Give and take a few points on that. Between that and the extreme view lies the reality of open source. And the question I want to ask, to frame really this presentation, is goes back to 30 years ago or so. The question is very simple. The software business today is a very, very successful business in general. Wall Street loves software as an investment category. The software business model based on licenses, end user licenses, enterprise licenses, is a massively profitable business model and has been a darling of the investors. What's going on now is open source proves that you can do that at a much lower cost. And where does this end? IBM, for example, 40 years ago, treated open source as loss leader, excuse me, software as loss leader. The industry was about hardware, it was about services, And system engineers were out there in the field writing the software, but it was not thought of as an independent business, just an enabler, a loss leader for the rest of the industry. Then came along Microsoft and the Bill Gates of the world. By the way, I'm a huge fan of the Microsoft stuff and that way of thinking about software, because what it says is very simple, is developers should make money, and lots of it if possible. And they've definitely succeeded at that. And so the polarity I think we're dealing with in you know 5-10 years out is open source software a standalone category? And obviously us at JBoss, folks like MySQL, etc., we're down there proving that it is, that we can build viable, standalone, sustainable, cash flow positive business models. Or is it just a loss leader? Because there will be no profits and you must fund the software from somewhere else, be it a hardware line, be it a services line, or be it a legacy line that you can still monetize. That to me is what's going on, and obviously I'm gonna evangelize today on the fact that just like the Microsofts of the world 30 years ago invented the license and proved that software was a standalone business model, we hope to prove, as we're doing, that open source software is a standalone business model. Our evolution has been driven by the market. I left Sun in 99, started the project EJBOSS. Sun lawyers told me that the EJB was a trademark, so I had to drop the E, so it became JBoss, and I think it's a much better name. So I have the Sun lawyers to thank for the marketing. In 2000, basically, actually, my first company disappeared because March 2000 came along, and so we couldn't find funding. I went back to Atlanta to live at my in-laws, so now I was 32, a kid, a dog, my wife, and living at my in-laws. Not the proudest moment in my life. And you know, we were the in-laws garage company type of thing. We started doing training and selling documentation, which was very controversial at the time. I mean, 2000 to me, you know, was the peak of the hysteria around open source. Everything was going to be free, it was going to be great, it was going to be peace and love. San Francisco had won, right? And there I was, after 2 years of this, really burning out and still not making real money and saying, throwing my hands up in the air, how am I going to make a living at this? And then what happened is that a bunch of customers sent me an email saying, Mark, can you train us on JBoss because we'd like to develop on it? And I said, you know what, I can do that. So I spent 3 months at my in-laws writing a training. And it's a very easy way, actually, to make a living. Let me give you some numbers. 20 people showed up to my first training at $3,000 a pop, so that was $60,000 for 1 week worth of work. Well, plus the upfront creation of the training, but it was very much a very scalable business model. I took that to London. We had 30 people at $3,000, $90,000 for another week of work. You know, so in 2 weeks in the first year, I'd made $150,000. My wife was okay with me doing free software. And so that's how we got started. I brought Scott Stark, my partner in the business, to do the documentation, and that was extremely controversial. How did we dare charge for $10 for our documentation? Well, it's because it enabled Scott to spend full time. Scott was making a lot of money as a lead developer at Bear Stearns, and so somebody also needed the money. Not a lot of it. In fact, he told me, you know, give me Stark and I'll come work for you for $30,000 a year. And he was 40 years at that time, 40 years old. And in the first year, we made about $200,000 in documentation, which he netted most of it. You know, but that was the birth of it, and by customer demand. Since then, we've evolved a lot. Some milestones were in 2002, you know, people doing JBoss Group LXC, which really was a failed experiment at open source. By nature, open source deals with another, professional open source, commercial open source, deals with, excuse me, let me restate that. Open source that makes money deals with an inherent polarity, which is, on the one hand, you have this small community of contributors that want to make a living at this, a large community of contributors that don't really care if you commercialize. But how do you, you know, make sure that because you're distributed, you have one central company and one direction as opposed to going in all directions? And I thought we could, you know, deal with the tensions of managing a group of independent contributors and paying them as subcontractors, and that failed. So we reinvented ourselves really under the leadership of an excellent gentleman, Bob Bickle, who was one of the founders of Bluestone, an ex-competitor, and then the general manager of the HP division, middleware HP division, who came on board with us and has been the head behind our corporate growth. We went for venture funding, actually, with a fine firm right here in Boston, Matrix Partners. The lead investor was David Skok, who was a competitor of ours, the founder of Silverstream, and so he knows the field intimately. And that was the birth of professional open source, as I'm going to present it now. And today I'm going to articulate professional open source, GEMS, the methodology, etc. What is professional open source? I am going to focus here on, again, self-sustained open source that makes money. I'm sorry if I maybe sound like a little bit of a dark cloud when I say I don't really believe in open source that doesn't have its funding. Whatever its funding is, whether it be a sugar daddy, whether it be a corporate open source funder, which is another flavor of professional open source, albeit not self-sustained. But you have other business models, all right? I'm not saying this is the end-all, be-all of the business models. I'm just saying this is what we're using. But other business models include Eclipse, for example. Eclipse is a very viable business model, and it's worth just describing that for 20 seconds before I dive into the particulars of our business models. JBoss, in fact, is an active contributor at Eclipse. We have two full-time developers that we fund on the WebTools project and the Eclipse IDE, et cetera. And the business model there is, I am a vendor, let's make no mistakes about it. I'm a software vendor. Sun's a software vendor, BEA, IBM, we're all software vendors, and for the life of us, we couldn't come up with a decent IDE in Java. And we were all spending money trying to come up with our own cute little IDE, and IBM was making, you know, fools out of us. And that was a lot of money wasted on a lot of products that were going nowhere. Witness, BEA, and the several iterations of their IDE, and now it's in the trash can at Apache, called whatever. Eclipse says, we all put a little bit of money, and that money has to come from software. That money doesn't grow on tree. Has to come from somewhere, excuse me. We all put a little bit of money, but we end up with a very decent IDE that can actually compete with Microsoft. That's the business model for the vendors. It's a business model that makes a ton of sense to us as a vendor, and for the price of a couple developers and the participation in Eclipse, we come up with a decent product. That business model you'll find as well in some government-sponsored open-source projects, which basically says each one comes with its own funding. You'll see that in the medical field, for example. There's a lot of upstarts there. You'll see that in the World Bank organization on the Round the Portal efforts, etc. You know, where the idea is everybody comes in, puts a little bit of money, and then it works. Right? Because again, one of the romantic exaggerations of open-source is that people work for free. And everybody here, they do.
I can't.
You know the saddest story. Go ahead, please.
I can't even believe that you. Right? I mean, it's all a matter of the definition of terms here, but people do work for things other than direct monetary compensation.
Well, that is true, and that is a motivation. To stand here and say that people work for free full time is dangerous. The saddest story I read 2 days ago in Wired was about this legend of the Usenet groups, you know, that apparently was an absolutely genius and discussing Kant and discussing politics and discussing software and was a legend in the 90s, and the article is about he lives in the streets right now. And he bums off time of the computer. I'm sorry, I don't want to leave that back.
Well,
you know?
Well, wait.
I don't. I just don't. If that's your thing,
no,
do it.
Wait.
Do it.
Wait.
Do it.
Wait.
If that's your thing, go ahead. Sir, okay. Have you contributed anything to any open source project? Let's start there.
I'm leading an open source project
one?
That has existed for 10 years. It's called Etherboot.
Etherboot. That's
And I run
excellent.
I run the website ramomatic.net.
And how do you fund it? How do you fund your time? You have another job.
I do have another job.
So
but
you
what
do
I'm
that.
Trying to say is, and what's important is, that what you are doing is bashing a straw man and making the perfect the enemy of the good. What you're saying is you're either a pauper living in the street as a bum and writing open source all day, or you just do open source for money all the time. People like myself are somewhere in the middle. What we do is we have jobs and we spend a certain amount of our time to do that.
You are what I categorize as amateur open source. Okay? And I'm serious. And there is no judgment here. And I respect you. And I respect you. Excuse me?
I mean, what's the other extent? Amateur to asshole?
This is very interesting. This is going to be good.
Wow.
So the supercomputing...
So I'll tell you what.
Supercomputing clusters that use our ROMs to boot their supercomputing clusters, they're just using some amateur stuff that we came up with.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Fine.
That's right.
Very good.
And if it works on that amateur open source model, then so be it. And that's great. And I'm not bashing that, right? For me to make money and live at that, whatever. Yes, so we do like money, and I'm very much on the Microsoft side.
As an amateur photographer and amateur, you know, there's a big, amateur music is a huge business and stuff like that. Amateur is an important part, but we'll listen
yeah,
to the...
Yeah, so I'll apologize for everybody, to everybody. We do like making money at this. Okay. So what we want out of this is a real software company. To do this at night when I want to see my kid and spend time with my wife and put my kids through good schools and send them to fine universities like Babson or the Boston College that cost a lot of money, we need to make money somewhere here, and I like my time at night. So again, I am focusing here on self-sustained open source. Open source that can sustain its development either with a lot of time, as the fine gentleman expressed here for 10 years has been doing that, while he has another job, which is great, and thank you very much for Etherboot. Or we accelerate and we become a real force by funding this as we go. Otherwise, we're going to default to corporate open source. The first generation were Red Hat and SUSE, and the big difference between the first and the second generation is that the first generation were packagers. This is still the romantic ideal of open source somehow happens by the goodwill of generous people. Let it happen, and then corporate entities monetize it, usually independently of the people that actually wrote the code in the first place. But in the case of Red Hat, SUSE, and Linux, you have seen a professionalization of Linux today. Today, Linux is professional open source, which says what? The natural ecosystem of complex software systems is 1,000 developers on Linux kernel, for example, 1,000 CVS read-write passwords. And when I asked Linus Torvalds, how many people really write Linux? He said, well, there's, you know, really, really 80% of Linux is written by 20 people. And those 20 people are all professionals, full-time employees, at Red Hat, at SUSE, at IBM, at OSDL, including Linus at OSDL. And he said, there's 900 people who have written one or two patches. That is the software ecosystem. And that's true of proprietary companies. There is a pyramid of productivity. What we're saying is that in open source, we are funding that top of the pyramid for those who want to do that full time, as opposed to amateur. And I did not mean amateur in a disrespectful way. We all started there. Second generation embraces the nature of a vendor. We are a vendor that distributes software under free software licenses. We fund the development. We accelerate the development. We're a software vendor. So let's talk about the business model for a second. It's kind of a best of both world thing, where you have the traditional software company attributes, a methodology of development, which we've honed. Today, JBoss funds 23 projects in open source. And out of those 23 projects, we produce about 7 products. And out of those 7, 4 are category leaders. That methodology, for example, we've applied to Tomcat at Apache. Even though Tomcat is hosted at Apache, we contribute. In fact, we lead the development at Apache full-time, providing the roadmap, providing the bug fixes, and animating that community. And we derive revenue from the services. We're a pure play free software. And I insist on free software as opposed to open source here, in the sense that we do not do a dual play, for example, a bait and switch strategy or a hook and then sell, you know, the kiddie enterprise in open source and then the four adults professional, you know, professional product. That's not our model. Everything is under free software licenses. And if you guys want to discuss about the fine prints of the licensing, we seem to have a lot of Hare Krishnas in the room, I'll be glad to. Non-traditional attributes from open source. Zero license revenue. And that's important for the client. And high leverage of the model, meaning we come off a huge run in the 90s where people paid a lot of money for software and ending up at shelfware. And in fact, the thing that Microsoft has invented 30 years ago, and to me very correctly, is that you should pay for the value of creating, marketing, distributing, selling, and supporting software. And I read the letter to hobbyists, open letter to hobbyists, which I'm sure was as heated an exchange as we'd want to have here. You know, where he was saying, you guys are stealing from me. Why? Because creating software takes money. QAing software takes money. Distributing software takes money. Selling it takes money. And I need to make a living at this. So we invent the EULA. It may be that in 30 years, we will think of the EULA as an historical accident of the software industry. I'm more of the thinking that you're going to see a stratification of software. And in infrastructure, these models will prevail. I don't see an SAP going, you know, really being challenged out there today or even in 10 years. We'll see. But so what's leveraged now is that the value that the customer pays for is the value of the knowledge and the value of service, not the value of software creation, because what has changed today compared to the time when Bill G. wrote that open letter to lobbyists is the internet. It's as simple as that. We're little ants running in agitation figuring out the impact of the internet still. And the impact is that we can create software in a collaborative way at lower cost. We can distribute it at no cost. We can market it at very low cost. We can sell it at lower cost, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same business model, just leverage and enable, and it enables players like us, MySQL, SleepyCat, et cetera, to bring software with no licenses and still make a decent living at this. And it's a powerful model in general. I think open source has a monopolistic nature intrinsically. If you look at, you know, the infrastructure of a lot of the net, you know, the TCP/IP stacks, things like that, open sources are not right monopoly. If you go up the stack in the operating system realm, you will find Linux with 30% market share in a very hotly contended area, which is remarkable if you think of it. No one has ever done that to Microsoft, and Linux is doing it successfully. Go up the stack, Apache is a remarkable phenomenon. First on the market with a good product, nuked the market in terms of financial value, but 70% market share. Go up the stack, you'll find MySQL with close to 50% market share, depending on how you measure, but definitely a volume leader. Go up the stack, you will find players like JBoss, where we have number one market share in AS, number one market share in Tomcat, number one market share in Hibernate. Hibernate actually has been a category killer. There is a dark nature to what we're doing, which is Hibernate has destroyed the persistence market. There is no standalone persistent vendor any longer. It's over. The last standalone player was Persistent Software, aptly named, and it was sold for peanuts to Progress Software. The other one was TopLink, and it's surviving at Oracle. Portal, we're coming strong. We neglected Portal a year ago. We invested heavily in 6 months ago, and already the number of downloads we have completely overtaken the other open source portals, including JetSpeed and Liferay and Exo by a factor of 3. And so we're repeating that formula. This is a cookie cutter, mindless machine. We're putting in, I'm exaggerating. It is not mindless. It's a machine where this will end up. You know, I have a Napoleonic ambition about the footprint. Well, everybody dies eventually, right? We might as well have fun in the time being. Customer adoption. Some verticals are very strong, telco, banks, government. I know there's a lot of government folks here. I have a slide actually on government. Essentially, counterintuitively, everywhere, it's the very high end that embraces commercial open source because there's a large CPU count there. And depending on how your pricing is done, for example, Linux is still with a CPU pricing, so that breaks down in high CPU. But our pricing and other people's pricing, you know, can remove the per CPU. And for example, we have four dimensions of pricing, SLA, SLA number of seats to our network. Long story short, the pricing scales to the very high end, and these are mission-critical environments. Customer satisfaction, not about the product, but about the service. One of the myths, I think, of open source is that open source has no support. And it's funny because there's that binary, confused talk in the press. It's either the communities have better support. Put your problem on a forum and people will drop everything they do and work for free for you on Thursday night to fix your problem. That's the one exaggeration on the one hand. And the other hand is from the corporate guys that go, there is no support for open source. Everybody knows that. Only proprietary vendors can give open source. When the reality of it is, and I'm sure this satisfaction is can be reproduced in the Linux camp. If you have those numbers, I'd be very curious to see what's the customer satisfaction on the services piece. In JBoss, we achieved that because it's a different way of doing the support. That's our value add. We focus on it. That's our only value. And therefore, we take it very seriously. And this slide, from a financial standpoint, is the most important one. And I'll explain why in a second. Yeah.
Sorry, just curious on that last slide. What is the label on the y-axis?
The label, oh, yeah, it's from 1 to 7.
Of what? 1 to 7 what? What's the unit?
Are you satisfied with the unit numbers? I'm confused, I'm sorry. The vendor provides excellent value for my support services investment. From 1 to 7, agree, disagree.
Okay.
And we'll often start at 3.
And this is a survey of JBoss users.
So this is a survey of our customer base that uses BEA and IBM. So we did not count the users that only use JBoss, because obviously that would bias the study towards JBoss if they dumped a competitor. This is only the subset of our customers that use JBoss and still use the competition. So they're not necessarily dissatisfied with the competition, okay? And obviously, if they don't use the JBoss, they can't rate JBoss. We made it to the Gartner Magic Quadrant recently, and we're very proud of that. For a 150-person company to be rated as capable of executing equal to a Microsoft and an IBM is no small feat, and that's why I think this company is so, the energy is so high. There is more visibility than our size would warrant. I know there's a lot of government folks here, so I don't mean this to sound salesy. There is a little bit of sales at the end. But really, obviously, OSS is a natural for government agencies around the world for various reasons. Number one, natural escrow of code. Governments are really big into controlling their own destinies. In fact, it's funny, the first customer of JBoss, not a government agency, it was the Mormons in Salt Lake City, I'll accelerate, because they think about their software for 1,000 years. And so we power familytreesearch.org, and they adopted us very early. But it puts the client back in the driver's seat. You are not the victim of licenses anymore and the vendors that give you the license. That's very important. The pricing models can be scalable. We're used pervasively in the U.S. government agencies, DISA, DARPA, Navy, with the portal, Justice Department, State. Government integrators are adopting it, the whole gamut. Our largest deal today is the French IRS. And we just funded our government group. We hired the CIO of the U.S. Treasury to head our sales effort. That's Drew Lattner. So somebody who understands your problems, or understands your language, or understands the landscape, and can help you make sense of an open source stack and strategy in agencies. So let us know if you're interested to know more about that. Also, I heard through the grapevine that there may be legislations that mandates that the cheapest solution that does the job be used regardless of whether it's proprietary or not. I don't know if it's real. If it is, that should definitely give a boost to open source. That is the case already in South America and in some European community governments. doing it yourself, because we're here about how do you build an open source. I'm going to focus on how do you build a successful open source. Okay, so the vendor perception as a vendor now, you know, the perception that it's free developers. Oh my God, 1,000 guys are going to work for me for free. How great is that? You know, it's free marketing, free sales, free QA, free distribution standards, and it's so hot right now. It's the silver bullet. The reality of it is this. No licenses to grow on. And what does that mean? That means that there is a not a polarity, but a binary stable mode. One sucks, the other one's great. The one that sucks is if you have no critical mass. If you're a small project with no user base, then trust me, first of all, nobody's going to help you for free. That's a myth. You know, after 3 years of throwing my life's, you know, savings and my energy into JBoss, I had a success, which for me was 10 guys actually helping me and making money with me doing consulting. You know, I heard the previous presentation, the guy says, I have 6 commuters, and it sounds like nothing because the press has said 1,000 commuters. 6 commuters after I don't know how long Hula's been around, that's good. That's actually remarkable that they could rope in 6 guys to write software for free for them, right out of a pool of 70 contributors. That's remarkable. But you're going to have the cost of development by and large. You're going to have the cost of sales. Why? Because if you're not known, how do you get known? You still have to fund your sales. You're going to have your cost of QA. QA, by the way, is the biggest thing in open source that is true. I'm happy debunking myths of open source one after the other. QA is the one thing that is truly, and I will stand to death, truly superior in open source. Why? Because we distribute millions of copies, and just the combinatorials of the testing in the field cannot be matched by a proprietary QA. End of story. Trust me on that. Marketing, you have to pay. Basically, you're just a normal startup, except you don't have license revenues, which is usually how startups grow. So it's bad. It's the poorly performing stage of the business model. Critical mass. Getting critical mass is, first of all, a rare event. You need luck there. You know, the critical mass projects, there may be, I don't know, I want to say 10. You know, definitely Linux, Apache, MySQL, JBoss, Berkeley DB, on and on. They are there, but they're not that many critical mass. Why? I think it has to do with our brains. We cannot store 10 attributes alongside the open source word. We can maybe store 6 words. So you're going to have 6 brands. That's what I'm getting at. It's a branding problem. How many brands have achieved critical mass out there? But once you have that brand critical mass, then your cost of sale goes to zero. I'm exaggerating. In our enterprise field, the average cost of sales is about $1.08 to $2.05 per dollar of maintenance we bring in. That's the average. At JBoss, we spend 20 cents for every dollar of maintenance that comes in. Why? Because the brand's out there, the distribution's free, people test it, they put it in production, then they approach us. We don't have to fund a massive sales force. Ergo, we compete on a disruptive basis with our competition. Right. So that's the critical mass where it works. You still must pay for that top talent. I'm not the one to say, you know, do this at night and on weekends. That's where everybody starts. I do not hire somebody that comes to me saying, oh, I want to do open source, but you got to pay me. No, first you got to prove that you are truly an open source developer. Do that on an amateur basis. And then you want to do it full time. For example, Gavin King at Hibernate was a great example of somebody who's project success was driving him nuts. His girlfriend left him, was working at nights, was working on weekends, just no time. He said, I got to do this full time. That's it. And that's when we join and we have a performing business model. Some more deep thoughts. The subscription-based revenue business model is an interesting one. That's a bigger trend going on in the industry. A lot of people are going to subscription-based as the right way to purchase software. What's nice from a purely financial standpoint is that it's highly predictable and renewable from a revenue standpoint. Basically, it's a formula. If you have 65% renewals, which I believe is the case in the Linux camp, at least the case for Red Hat, then take your revenue year one, 65%, and continue. You have an exponential growth. That's the definition of an exponential, when the delta of your number is a proportion of your number. What I just said in mathematical words is that the scalability of the enterprise model is untouched under open source business model. Take a startup, it's 80% licenses, 20% maintenance. Take a midlife company, it's 50-50. Take a mature business model, like the Novell's, the CA, it's the reverse. What builds up over time is the license. Excuse me, is the revenue, is the subscription. I'll get it. Easily cash flow positive, and it's the new trend. It's a bigger trend than open source. It just happens that open source and that trend match very well. Here's a point for the CFOs in you. GAAP profitability is a killer in terms of growing a business. I'll go on record saying it's stupid. Driving for GAAP profitability during growth phases is suicide if you are in a subscription business model. Why? And I'll just go quickly. Because the way we do revenue recognition. We do rev rec on a daily basis. Therefore, you give me $365, I'll recognize $1 every day. But if I leave that money in the bank to show GAAP profitability, I'm not reinvesting in the business. So just like Red Hat does, we operate on a cash flow zero basis. And so we show GAAP non-profitability, but really there's more money coming in than there's money leaving, right? Our bank account is growing, just for the record. Stability of pricing in second generation versus first, and this is specifically targeted at you folks at Novell. What's going on in the pricing in the first generation is that Linux is Red Hat Linux, SUSE Linux, Red Flag Linux, and the differentiator is your brand, your reputation, your capacity to service. And your customer base. That's it. But essentially, the price is falling through the floor. And I heard, Jack, you talking about the asymptote, you know, of where it would finish at BrainShare. Where's that asymptote? What's the dead market value? What is the dead market value of a industry that is undifferentiated at the source? That in second generation, we have less of that problem. Because JBoss supports JAMS, and if you want JAMS support, you go to JBoss. You don't go to Red Hat. In fact, Red Hat decided to not directly compete without us. At Novell, there's a different model. You do first line, we do third line. That's a traditional software vendor model and SI relationship. But that means there's a point of control in second generation that provides price stability. So it's a price stability point. Perfect Storm. It's obvious to me that what's happening here is just where, you know, there's an atomic bomb that has dropped on the anthill, and that's the internet, and the anthill being the software industry. And the internet enables us to deliver optimized models and the net allows us for distribution. You know, we're all of us, MySQL, JBoss, we're children of that. In fact, OSS in general. Economic climate shift of the value. The value is not in the software license. It's in the ongoing service and maintenance as you go to prod. Growing acceptance of open source is a thing that's bigger than us. That's not just JBoss or even Linux. Well, it is mostly Linux, actually. Linux is the big brother here. And what happens is because it's perception, it's a very steep barrier to entry. You know, oh, open source, dirty. No, we're not doing that. But once you get over that barrier that's very steep, the valley is very low, meaning once they go, why didn't we like open source 3 years ago? They go, I can't remember for the life of me. It's good software, great support, right price, let's go. That's what we're seeing in the enterprise right now. We call this the roll it out phase versus the try it out. So try it out, companies try us. Once it works, the support is good, it's roll it out, let's go. This is where we make our money. In the, you know, in the Innovator's Dilemma presentation about value creation and the disruptiveness to incumbents, this is an interesting shift because the value that open source creates does not necessarily go to the vendor and the developers that create that, but goes to the pocket of the end user in terms of savings. And that creates a craving because the value is self-feeding in the end user. So that I'm just trying to describe that there is a positive feedback, self-accelerating loop in that adoption. It's a perfect storm. And you know, people say, oh, is OSS for real? And still many, many presentations and articles are about, you know, should you do open source? It's not about that anymore. Everybody uses open source, everybody. I want to say safe 80% as one form of open source in the IT department. The real question is, how do you do it? With what model of services? Maybe absence of it and you depend on the free forums. Maybe an SI, maybe a vendor, maybe a partner of ours, maybe us directly. Those are the questions that today you should be asking yourselves. Not do I use open source, but what's the right way for us to deploy open source in your particular environment? And every environment is different, obviously. But it's here to stay. And I think we have Luckily, just 5 minutes for questions.
The reason we had Marcus, the keynote for lunch was to get things going here. And so any questions? Yes. Oh, good one to have for a question.
So it's the first time I've been called an asshole in a keynote. That was pretty good. That was pretty good.
I really enjoyed your presentation. I thought it was outstanding. I'm Don Dodge. I'm from Microsoft.
You're not helping me here.
I'd like to ask you this. If you were starting all over again and you had to compete with JBoss or you had to compete with MySQL, how would you do it?
Ask that to IBM.
Do you think it could be done?
Ask to IBM. Do they think it can be done? Yeah. You try. They're going to try. So everybody has open source. So Sun just announced that they open source their app server. IBM announced that they will at one point in the future have an app server. Let me tell you the discussion I had with Danny Saba and the current CEO of CA. Swainson, John Swainson, very much. Thank you very much. They were still at IBM. And that was about 18 months ago. And I love Saba because even though he's an executive, he can talk aspect orientation at a research level with me, being the head of IBM research. And they were very open about, you know, we copy the Microsoft model, which is promote technical talent so that we know what we're doing here. But Swainson started the talk by saying, okay, Mark, there's going to be three points of equilibrium in 5 years. Microsoft, IBM, and you. That's it, right? Those are going to be the monopolistic poles that control middleware in the future. I strongly believe that, right? And I'd like to be the guy with a 70% market share at that point, right? And to compete with an established open source project is very difficult. Let me tell you why. We are operating at dead value, dead market value. IBM is very comfortable operating below dead market value, meaning loss leader, like you guys have done to Netscape, right? To the whole software world. They don't care. Well, today they care at $3 billion, and there was an excellent article in Business Week 2 days ago saying, middleware, IBM open IBM embracing middleware in open source? I don't think so. And the guy goes through all the numbers and why he goes, this is just FUD, right? There is no way Steve Mills lets go of the leash he has on, you know, you know the numbers there. With the hardware going down, the services going down, it's software that's growing and they gotta continue. So they're just trying to get control of the timeline. It's inevitable, and IBM recognizes that. What they're doing here is on their timeline so that they can have a soft landing as opposed to the Mars lander thing that we had pulled on them, right? But how can they compete with me since I have a free product? Today, I have a product. No one else really has a product, first of all. And then even when they have a product, they need to get it production ready, and then they compete with us on the basis of what differentiator? The IBM brand, because the software's free and the support, we'll see, right? So I'm really not worried. And I find it amusing that now everybody's going open source because it starts smelling of desperation out there.
When David Skok spoke in an earlier thing that we had several months ago.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah, he did. And it was packed in a much smaller room. It wasn't as nice as. But he talked about the value, the importance of the critical mass.
Yes.
And that as an investor, he can't create a critical mass.
Yes.
But he can look for it. Okay. But I'm reminded of Microsoft went against a critical mass, which was Lotus with 1-2-3. By investing an enormous amount of money, and an unbelievably enormous amount of money, and changes, they were able to wrest it away in Excel. But it took a king's ransom, more than a king's ransom, to be able to do that. But the value, and I think one of the things to learn, which you've pointed to, is the value of critical mass.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just mean that you're open source, because there are open source projects you've wiped out. But the value of critical mass and sometimes pouring money in, because even the amateurs may not be able to go up against.
The amateurs
love to be paid. If you pay the amateurs, they're even more happy sometimes.
Absolutely.
But that Now that only takes, but that you're only going to get the money for certain projects. There are lots of projects you're not going to get the money like that for. But
yeah,
that's an important thing.
I think that's a valid point. I'm not saying that this model is applicable to all open source out there. Frankly, right. I don't think it is. Right, you need critical mass of enterprise, and you need to be mission critical and moving fast enough so that people want to buy that. Right.
Because as we talked about the elephant, we're looking at an elephant here, and we're looking at here maybe
but,
one of the
you know,
lakes.
We're focusing on steady state here, meaning where does this end? And where it's at is close to dead market value, the asymptote that Jack was talking about. And what's the value of that service, period.
We have another question.
What's interesting to me is the dynamics of that. And that's what IBM's trying to do. They're trying to, wait, let's get.
Going half with Illuminata. I think this digs down into a little bit deeper of the comment you just made, actually. You know, you've got a mission critical horizontal application. This business model works for that. Where do you see the balance sort of on the one hand where basically an amateur project can probably work pretty well, and the other sort of on the other side of the scale where you really don't see a valid open source model existing at least today at all?
Yeah, you know, again, I not that I'm humble, but I want to make sure I communicate that this model, in fact, would fail in many other open source projects because of the nature of, you know, horizontal, fast moving, et cetera. Specifically, where I don't see this applicable in software may be the ERP arenas. I know Jörg Janke for Compeer, you know, he's a personal friend. In fact, his wife came to us 4 years ago saying, I'm tired of him. No, Jörg was, so he competes with SAP. He's the leading ERP vendor. Open source vendor. And Jörg is 50 years old, and he was the lead developer at Oracle, on Oracle Apps, made a lot of money, and then decided to take the jump and just write open source. And his wife came to me saying, we can't continue like that. He loves this. He's the love of my life, so I want him to be happy, but you know, we need to eat. And I said, have him do a training. First year, half a potato. The wife is happy as anything, and he started an embryo of a company. So he will be very cash flow positive, very profitable. In fact, he may be wealthy, and I'd be very happy if the class of open source developers has a social status on a steady state basis in 10 years that's comparable to lawyers and doctors, meaning you can make a living at this, you know, on an ongoing basis. And if the ERP layers reach that, that's great. Now, that being said, I don't believe the ERP layers are going to follow that same model. The web browser, you know, I don't know. I'll tell you one thing that really, really pisses me off. I heard recently from RVC in Silicon Valley that Mozilla.org, and anybody correct me if that rumor is wrong, that Mozilla.org just made $40 million. Do you know how? Google Ads. Now, because they're structured as a nonprofit, nobody can touch that money. And already, the whole thing's falling apart because as soon as you introduce, you know, that dose of reality in what was otherwise a fairly woohoo world, you know, you got to manage that. And the fact that this, you know, that idealism of nonprofit, and why does open source equal nonprofit? I don't get that. You know, why does, it was the Microsoft rant of 30 years ago. I'd love to meet Bill G one day just to go, we're still trying to do the same thing, but just dealing with the reality of modern software production. But we're still very much on that end of the spectrum here, which is why the emotions ran so high. We're done.
When I asked the question earlier about when the schism would occur, I didn't think we'd witness it this morning, but first of all, it's clear to me that what you're doing is logical, it's historical, it works, and that was what I was alluding to earlier, that the IBMs of the world are not going to sit back and let a volunteer process dominate $4 billion of their investment.
That's
so
right.
What you're doing is perfectly historically true. However, it's not the only historical path that you can look to. It's easy to live in the moment and say, it's all over. It's not all over. You know, we're still living in a disruptive period. Look at the internet. E-tailing, B2B, all those things are still evolving. Mm-hmm. Open source isn't done evolving yet. So some things
I agree.
But here's another analogy. NGOs, nonprofits. The world is full of very large, very influential nonprofits. The world is full of people giving billions of hours of time a year to nonprofits. So I think what you're going to see is a layering. The big mission-critical software platforms, absolutely. The big vendors of the world are not going to let those out of their control.
Right.
But you don't have 100,000 projects at SourceForge doing enterprise-level software. You've got all kinds of useful, good things that don't have so many dollars associated with them that you're ever going to get Microsoft or IBM interested in them. There's also different purposes of things that you can do
that somebody
like JBoss will never want to get involved.
If I said anything in this presentation that
makes you say
that.
Will be people who are very committed, very full-time, and maybe making what amount to nonprofit salaries, you know, servicing that end of the world. So no question JBoss is going to be out there,
but no question
going to be out there.
You know,
I'm sorry, I don't know your name. But no question that Marty's going to be out there and whole bunches of people in between.
I'm a quantum, I did my master's in theoretical physics, and I'm going to take a quantum physics analogy. Reality in quantum physics is multiple path, and there's just probability on them, and they all exist. So you have this reality, that reality, that reality. I'm fighting for a parallel reality, which is open source as a standalone money-making machine, right? Which doesn't exclude the other, but what I would be sad with is if the future has, you know, just, oh, well, it's got to be nonprofit. Or, for example, France with Jonas, which is the stuff, you know, bundled by Red Hat. So they're government employees, you know, doing that, and it's a government funding of it. And then the idea is, well, this is common infrastructure. Government should fund it, and France is doing that. And that's fine, right? That's one of those realities. The other reality is IBM, which is saying, this whole software thing could go to hell. I couldn't care less. In fact, let's go dead market value and below and nuke it all, right? I think it's, in all seriousness, I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be a combination of all these three, and I may be a little bit too evangelical for my own church here. But I think today that's a fact. You know, we know it works. We're not the only ones. Others are popping up everywhere, copying that model. We're happy that is the case. We let go of the professional open source trademark to make sure those who could use it. And I think at the end of the day, more importantly, why this parallel reality is going to exist is that the customer doesn't care. As long as the software is free, whether it's produced by IBM or a bunch of hotheads or an amateur guy that's his hobby and that's his pleasure, they don't care. Right? It's good software, and if there's support, they're going to use it. So, you know, the customer, we care because we want those realities to coexist. The customer doesn't care. Yeah.
Back to IBM.
Hi. Actually, we do care.
As a vendor or as a user? It's IBM. I said the vendors care. We all care.
Yeah.
It's the customer that doesn't care.
My point was we actually do care if the software goes to hell. The fallacy of your argument is that software isn't one thing. It's 100,000 things. And in much the same way that, you know, 20 years ago we sat around trying to differentiate ourselves based on our TCP/IP stacks. And that became less interesting as we innovated up the stack.
Yeah.
And that became a commodity level.
Yeah.
There is, at least our belief is, that there's a tremendous amount of unexplored potential innovation that's going on. And that open source is a very natural progression, natural part of the evolution of our industry, and it's something to acknowledge and to embrace. And there are going to be certain levels of our technology stack that will be addressable by open source technology and open source business models. And we're very happy about that, and we're going to move on and innovate into areas further up the stack, into new spaces, and continue to innovate. And it's not a matter of us, you know, running scared and going, ooh, about something. And for that matter, you know, WebSphere and JBoss or WebSphere and Glue Code aren't the same entity, right? I mean, WebSphere is a small app server with a huge collection of extension services that do all kinds of weird and wonderful things. And we're going to continue building those services, and we're going to layer them on top of the Geronimo code base, and we're just going to keep on moving on with this. Software is not one thing. It's tons and tons of things.
I don't disagree.
About one level of it.
I don't disagree. I'd like to expand on the word you said, which is innovation. You know, I sit on a lot of panels about innovations, the value of patents, and to me, it's about innovation. And when a Microsoft can put, you know, billions of dollars into research, or an IBM can do IBM research, and I present it to Watson, and you have a lot of fine folks in the labs, and you know, that to me, on a macro humanistic level, has a lot of value. You know, this is us moving forward. And what I'm striving for, you know, I'm not sure we disagree on anything, actually, which is why the word fallacy is, you know, what parts are viable, durable, where can we sustain innovation in that ecosystem, which I agree with you is going to be totally stratified. We, Sean, you know, when people come to us, say, oh, why don't you take my vertical app and open source? And we go, that's not our business. That's not what we do. We do infrastructure. And so, you know, there was an article by Dan Lyons in Forbes that, you know, called me not an asshole, but basically laughed at me, right, for my naivete. And yeah, it's a great article. So it's a great article.
He read that, yes.
Yeah, I encourage you to go see it, which was rebuked by the Business Week guy. Dan is on a path to destroy open source, the journalist, you know. And so he wrote four articles, and he wrote about the friend of Linus Torvalds. What's his name? Larry McVoy, the guy from BitKeeper, something like that. And basically, the guy's been doing open source for 5 years, and he's even... I won't say he's worse than me, right? He goes, open source will never work. You know, where I know it will work. I know we'll be, you know, us and a lot of other folks will be successful with this. But, you know, he goes, we can't sustain innovation. And if that's the case, then it should be made illegal. I am serious. If this proves that we cannot continue sustaining innovation, it's not because we can do it, that we should do it. Arrest me while you can. Because I'm going to go so nuclear on you guys. It's not going to be even funny. Where you make a lot of money, you think you have control of the timeline, you don't. You know, so... yeah, let's go. But we're all on the same side here, on the same side as far as innovation goes. I think, you know, the common thread even between Microsoft, IBM, and us is... No, us at JBoss now, I'm not talking... is, for me, it is important that there is innovation fueled by money at some stage. And I follow the same thinking when I talk about patterns and blah, blah, blah. But I totally agree with that. So however you can fuel it.
We've run over a bit, but one more? Because, well, we're going to... Okay, because I think we're getting pretty tired out here, but it's...
I'm okay. Bring it on.
Steve Patterson.
I actually truly enjoyed this, so...
My one question about free software, whether it's IBM, Novell,
you mean free software or open source? Just
free software.
Free software.
And is the business model around it is all based upon a constant of innovation, and once the innovation stops, the support and services decline. If you look at, for instance, Parametric Technology right now, that's a good example of, you know, there's mm-hmm. not a lot of change in their industry right now. Mm-hmm. They could produce new products, mm-hmm. but there's not that much uptake for new products, so most of the revenues are support, and it's not a growing business. It's not an attractive business right now. It may be in 5 years, but the same thing is true in your business. When the innovation stops, how much support, how much training?
Yeah. It's the you know, revolution is like a bicycle. When it stops moving forward, it falls. Which was and it's a very good point that says, you know. Some people bang on open source, and by the way, if I make the distinction between free software, by free software I mean FSF, purely the foundation, as opposed to open source, loosey-goosey in general. You know, the argument against open source is you're just the Japanese car makers and electronic guys of the 70s and the 80s. You're copying what has been done somewhere else with standards, be it POSIX with Linux, HTTP with HTTPD at Apache, or J2E with JBoss, or SQL with MySQL, but you don't create, you don't innovate, you just copy, you make copycats, and you're destroying a viable ecosystem. How many times have I heard that argument? And the truth is, if that's the case, again, arrest me. I don't believe it is the case. I don't believe it is the case, and I believe that, in fact, just like the Japanese, yes, they started by copying, but then they started innovating in car manufacturing, in electronics, etc. I want to see open source taking the full measure of its responsibility, and I mean responsibility in a humanistic way, which is you got to continue with that innovation. If we stop, you know, we die. But, and now, coming back down a second, from my pure business model, you know, I have the luck of operating in middleware, and middleware, even from a research standpoint, is still a very active world. I wrote 3 papers on aspect-oriented middleware in academia last year, and everybody down the organization, we're very involved in research. You know, and that's not true of operating systems anymore. That's not as true of operating system. And so the dead market value of those markets is now purely service, packaging, distribution, which is why the Linux asymptote is very strong, right? The pricing from the Vail went from $1,000 to $600 to $300 in a year, right? That's Wall Street was freaked out. How can such a young market undergo such extreme price pressure? In our case, in middleware, I don't think we'll see such an extreme price pressure. First of all, IBM will not allow it, right? That's why they keep their timeline there. And then, you know, there's a lot of value in the innovation, in the knowledge transfer still. But for us to continue, we must continue with innovation. So here you have, out of the anthill and out of the multiple parallel worlds, here you have a player. I'm going to make the evangelical argument that we're a player where self-motivation drives innovation. We must innovate and die, right? Just like Microsoft had to include more stuff in the black hole, right? And for the vendors, it looks like a black hole, and you cannot escape it. Reality is once you get into the black hole, it's another universe with its own suns and its own, right? But that transition's scary. That transition's scary, you know, but yeah.
So I think it's time to go on to the next one. I really want to thank Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
We could have had a boring speaker for lunch.
And peace to everyone. You know?